This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Tech Talk and my name is Jeff Sandhu. The cybersecurity world has been rocked by major incidences in 2016. Just a few months ago, the Mirai botnet brought down huge major internet companies like Netflix, Spotify, Reddit and so forth. And over in Singapore, telco player StarHub got the short end of the stick with two major outages to its home broadband network, which were caused by targeted DDoS attacks on its servers. The world we live in seems a little bit scarier than what we thought. On the show today with me is Nick Fitzgerald. He's a renowned information security expert and also an ESET senior research fellow. Nick, what have we learned in 2016?
As a cynic, I'd say what we learned is don't trust cybersecurity experts to make predictions. Joking aside, a lot of security experts were concerned about the possibility of the Internet of Things being leveraged in some way or another for malicious intent and to achieve some kind of cybercrime objective or just perhaps to make a statement. But if you look back a year ago and see what people were predicting would probably be the big thing in 2016 when you were talking about cybersecurity, whilst, as I say, Internet of Things would have been mentioned, probably most people would have been talking about ransomware, which had been the major, really, issue for the previous year and even the year before that. They probably would have been talking about ransomware. And it's not to say that ransomware wasn't a big issue in 2016, but towards the end of 2016, we certainly saw that the predictions about how bad almost complete lack of security in large chunks of the Internet of Things, how bad that actually was, and how devastating the effects of someone deciding, let's get in there and see what we can do using this, actually was.
The Mirai botnet was probably a good example of it because, you know, it was just targeting devices that were still on, you know, the usual administration password protection level. It was such a level one security blips in that sense.
Absolutely. In fact, I would say, not to offend you, but I would say actually it wasn't level one, it was level zero. The attack, the Mirai botnet took advantage of what really weren't even vulnerabilities. It was just incredibly stupid design. The devices were working and doing what they were designed to do. And that means they were designed and implemented very, very badly. And the fact that someone was allowed to put it in a box and put it on a shelf and sell it in a shop is bordering on criminal itself.
So who's to blame in that sense? Like, is it just the lack of awareness from the consumers, us itself, or is it the guys who develop or manufacture these products are not, you know, aware of the risk that they're doing now that they're venturing into, you know, Internet of Things? They used to be probably makers of just, you know, normal, usual fans and microwaves and ovens, but now they're inputting technology in, not looking at security as something that they should consider here.
The consumer ultimately is, in some sense, I guess, responsible, but they're certainly not to blame. A decade ago, well, yeah, 20 years ago, let's go back further in history. 20 years ago, if you walked into the appliance section of a large department store and you bought a toaster or you bought a microwave oven or you bought a washing machine or you bought a refrigerator, you wouldn't even imagine that you would have to think, if I take this home and plug it in and turn it on, I might be causing trouble to someone on the other side of the planet. Or, vice versa, someone on the other side of the planet might somehow, through some clever machinations that I can't really think of, steal all the money out of my bank account. And whilst neither of those things quite are what happened if you buy, you know, a smart fridge or a smart washing machine or a smart TV, in a couple of years' time, a smart toaster, I believe that they're actually on the drawing board, if not actually close to going into production. It's just mind-boggling how fast the needle has moved. And all those kind of things, you actually have to start thinking, sadly, you have to start thinking, is there something I should be worried about here, which is way above my pay grade? And as the Mirai botnet showed, the answer to that question, at least today, through 2016 and obviously earlier, because many of these devices are devices that had been around in more or less the same form for several years before that. They weren't necessarily devices that were brand new, and you might have purchased a home security system with a web camera that was web-enabled and you could access it anywhere on the internet from your phone, blah, 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 all the cool things that people like. You might have bought it in September of 2016, and 2 months later it was part of the Mirai botnet taking all those sites that you mentioned offline and doing other damage around the internet. Or subsequently it's become part of one of the more than 20 Mirai-based, Mirai-related botnets, because after the guy that did Mirai, the initial attacks, proved his point, made his money, he released the source code, and so now basically anyone can grab the code and become a Mirai-like botnet botmaster. Even if you bought that device in September or October of 2016, it would have been designed in 2015 or 2014 or 2013, or the device might have been designed in January 2016, but it used a component that you could buy off the shelf from some manufacturer somewhere, and the reason the people that designed this web camera security system went, oh, look, these people have the cheapest web-enabled security cameras, not as a whole camera, but just as a electronic component that they can then make a case, provide the cables or the wireless connection or whatever to something else, and you know, the DVR component, etc., etc., and bang, you've got a problem. You know, the thing that's the problem might have actually been designed 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. A lot of these devices that the Mirai botnet use, not all of them, but a lot of them, have Telnet open. And not only do they have it open on the device, but they actually deliberately punch a hole through the firewall in your internet router so that that can be accessed over the internet. And that was, in many cases with the Mirai botnet, that was how trivially simple it was. The Mirai botnet agent, once it got on a device, would either start attacking websites or DNS servers that it was told to attack, or it would sit there and start scanning the rest of the internet to find other devices kind of like it that it could trivially compromise because they had a simple, well-known username and password on a port that really, if you have the vaguest understanding of computer security, should not be on the open internet. And if it is going to be there, there's all kinds of layers of security that you put on top of just having a simple username and password to access it, let alone a well-known username and password that you could Google. If you just happen to be looking around and you found one of these on the network from doing some simple network scanning, you could work out what it was from what it told you when you sort of first touched the device. It would give you some kind of header, and then you could search for that, and then you find out, ah, that's this webcam. Oh, and look, the default username and password is, you know, user, root, etc., whatever it might be. Then you know how to log into it if that hasn't been changed. And of course, most people, when they buy these devices, they quite reasonably assume that the people that designed and made them understand what the really bad risks are, and they took care of those. That stupid stuff that I just talked about would not work, because who in their right mind would design and sell in 2016 a device that could be taken control of over the internet so trivially like that? As an ordinary consumer, it's completely reasonable to assume that the people you're giving your hard-earned money to purchase one of these things had actually thought about that. Unfortunately, they haven't in many cases. And Mirai and the derivatives of it that we've seen since then, brilliant example of what can go wrong if enough people concentrating too much on doing it cheaply, doing it quickly, or making it easy and convenient without considering the deep underlying and far from difficult to understand, not necessarily easy to fix, but far from difficult to understand security issues that doing things in that way are likely to cause.
Nick, the cybersecurity world has always been playing catch up with the cyber criminals, and 2016 really saw the emergence of the cyber criminals operating like organizations. They're a lot more slicker, they're a lot more smarter than any of the cybersecurity experts that at least I've spoken to, and it's always seemed like we're playing catch up. Is there a way that we should maybe perhaps just stop doing things like, you know, this Internet of Things and, you know, making devices that are vulnerable and just look at it, and until we get it fixed, then we start moving forward? Or is this the consumer demand is just too much and there's so much money being made by all these organizations developing all these smart toasters and smart fridges that they just don't see the importance in trying to, you know, mitigate the risk?
That's a really, really good question, and that encapsulates basically all of the problems that are just built into this whole ecosystem. People want, and it's completely reasonable, people want simple, convenient things to help them get on with their ever-increasingly complex lives. And as I said at the end of my answer to your previous question, if you lay down your hard-earned cash to buy one of these devices that, you know, in some way is going to improve your life, it's reasonable to assume as the consumer, it should be reasonable to assume, that the people designing and developing this have actually done that work and thought through that. Mm. And unfortunately, someone has an idea. Yeah, let's put our toasters online. I mean, what could be more useful than that? Actually, I can't think of anything less useful. But, just using it as a silly example. Let's put our toasters online, and then it's like, well, someone else will think of this any day if, in fact, they haven't. So it's like, let's get our toaster into the market first. Let's get our internet-connected toaster to the market first, because otherwise someone else will beat us and they'll make all the money. And so it doesn't matter that we had a good idea. And unfortunately, the economic imperatives that then tend to drive the development of the idea and the design and implementation of the product, unfortunately, the economics for that tend to work against everything else, and especially because it's historically seen as something that gets in the way and slows things down, doing security. And so many of these things are designed and implemented and tested, and then they iterate, they change things a bit, etc., etc., and then bang, it's to market, huge advertising, big media push, etc., etc. Everyone gets excited about it, goes out and buys it. And then someone sits down one day with one of these fancy new devices and goes, oh, look, how stupid is that? And sadly, that's not usually someone who actually understands, in the example of our internet-connected toaster, our fictional internet-connected toaster, it's not someone who's worried about how well it makes toast. It's someone who understands internet security. Yeah. And whatever's wrong about the way they've done the implementation of the security for that device or a whole class of devices is then exposed and is probably starting to sound, in our hypothetical example, like so many real-world examples that we've seen and heard over the last few years. A couple of years ago, 18 months ago, I was flying to Europe on a very long flight from being living in New Zealand. I had two very long flights to get to Europe. And I happened to be, just completely by chance, happened to be sitting next to a guy who worked in the electronics department of a company that makes components for, he said, a large number of the major European car manufacturers. He admitted to me without, I mean, other than like introducing myself and telling him after he told me what he did, telling him that I was a computer security consultant, he chuckled and he said, oh, I think we'll be talking to folk like you a lot in the next few years. And he just admitted without any prompting or digging or anything on my part that every time they have to design a brake pedal or an accelerator pedal or some kind of gizmo where you push a button or turn a knob or do something on your smartphone that causes something on the car's electronics to change, every time they design one of those things, they do it from scratch and they do it really fast and they do it really quickly, and they have to do it that way because their manager says, oh, we're doing this again, it's a new model car and the client wants it to be 20 cents per unit cheaper. And that is the bottom line. This guy was an engineer, and he was, he himself entirely understands what's wrong with that approach. But he said, we've tried to sit down and argue that, look, we should spend a few months design standard components that are well understood and well documented and well tested, and then we just alter the physical characteristics of the casing that it has to go in so it will fit in this design car or whatever. And the pushback that he always gets from the management is, yes, but it will be more expensive and we have to undercut our competitors, else this client will leave us and go to one of our competitors for this component. And so every time they just do this, and of course, the things that add cost are the things that get, the things that add apparently unnecessary upfront to get the basic function of this gizmo working are the things that get the least attention. And of course, computer security is way, way, way down that list. Mm. And that's kind of scary when you realize that in a typical modern car, there are probably in the, something in the order of 10 to 20 different networks connecting different devices together. In a typical modern car, if you, you know, when you put your foot down on the gas or you hit the brake pedal, you're not actually doing some physical thing like you used to once upon a time. You're not compressing hydraulic fluid that causes the actual brake calipers to close in on the brake pads and slow the car down. You're actually pushing a thing that looks just like one of those brake pedals but causes some electronics to send a message via some form of network connection inside the car
to
some other piece of electronics, which then tells some other piece of electronics to close the brake pads. And there may be several steps in that rather than the two that I just described. And so there's enormous levels of iteration going on, very, very obscure and hidden to most of us most of the time.
And it was seen with, I think earlier in 2016 with Jeep in the US and, you know, a team of hackers, partner up with Wired magazine and, you know, run a test on hacking the infotainment system. And from there, they could actually access the whole car itself.
Classic example. They compromised one device and through network connections, which you have to wonder why the heck the network for the information entertainment network in the car is able to talk to the engine control and the braking and those other control systems, but it could somehow. And these got, and as you say, those security researchers had worked all that out. They took over that vehicle and then used what in typical computer intrusion parlance is called lateral movement, where you compromise, you know, it's like maybe you fish one of the a low-level executive's personal assistant, and you fish her, and you get malware running on his or her computer, and then from there you start doing reconnaissance on the internal network inside that company, and then you find that, oh, there's a server over there that for some reason, although it has very sensitive data on it, this person actually has access to, and then you know, you discover that, well, Here's the company payroll. Here's sensitive contracts that the company's engaged in with companies in certain countries that they might not like it to be known that they're doing business with, and so on. And that's what we saw. Admittedly, they were hacking a Jeep, not some large corporation, but it's the same kind of tactics. One point of weakness can be, it's not necessarily always, it's certainly not always the case, but one point of weakness can be all that's needed if once the person's on that device, on that piece of whatever the network is internal, even though all the rest of it's nicely firewalled off, once they can get inside, they tend to be able to move, you know, laterally and do more damage or compromise more sensitive information if it's a corporate network and so on.
I'm speaking to Nick Fitzgerald. He's the Senior Research Fellow at ESET, and we're talking about the increasing threat of connected devices. And when we come back in just a moment, we'll talk about how to stay safe, hopefully, on BFM 89.9.
Begin forwarded message. BFM 89.9.
This is Tech Talk, and my name is Jeff Sandu, and I'm speaking to Nick Fitzgerald. He's the Senior Research Fellow at ESET, and we're talking about the increasing threat of connected devices. So what can we do, Nick? And, you know, now it's 2017 now. A lot of businesses probably have, you know, looked back at what went wrong in 2016, and, you know, we've talked about a lot of stories of that what went wrong, and we've scared the people enough now. What can they do? What should businesses do, or what can a consumer do in order for us to at least, you know, be protected again or be comfortable and trust the brands that are making these devices?
That's a very good question, and it's very hard to answer. The Internet of Things type devices, unfortunately, because of their scale, I mean the actual device themselves, they tend to be relatively low-powered devices. Often the only thing that they have that's of any value is network access, and that was exactly what the Mirai botnet leveraged, the fact that they could access lots and lots of these machines and cause each of them to generate a moderate amount of network traffic on the internet. But because they had so many tens or hundreds of thousands of these machines under their control, they could bring down what you would think should probably be bordering on bulletproof internet services that were absolutely crucial to many very, very large websites running reliably. So the individual devices are relatively low powered, they're relatively small, and unfortunately, they're also not necessarily at all obvious. It might be that you buy a product that's actually several devices that talk to each other, and you would never imagine that they also actually try and connect to the internet and talk to something else, or just sit there listening in case someone wants to talk to them. And that's part of the problem. People sometimes don't even realize that there might be an internet connectivity component to some device or some collection of devices that they've purchased. Other times, there's obviously some kind of internet connection here, because it's like once you take the thing home and plug it in and hook it up to your computer to configure it the first time, and then hopefully just like not have to think about it ever again, because most people don't want to think about, you know, their baby minder or their security cameras or whatever it might be. Don't laugh, because baby minders are being hacked all over the internet. Mm. The next thing, or at the end of, or somewhere during the installation process, you get prompted, oh, yeah, do you have a smartphone? Download our app. And, you know, it's like magically all of a sudden you can see what your webcams can see, or you can listen to your baby monitor. And then when you go to the office the next day, you can still do that from the office. And then, you know, you're on the bus or the train on the way home, and you check, and, oh, I can do it here too. And so it's like you're aware that they're internet connected, but of course, as a going back to something I've already said several times, it seems reasonable, and I think it's quite arguably is quite reasonable, that as a person who's not a computer security expert, as someone who you go to work, you do your job, you check your security cameras from your phone when you're not actually at home, it's reasonable to assume that the people who designed that device, and doubly ironically in this example because it is actually a security device, it's reasonable to assume that they understand enough computer and internet security to have not made your webcams available to the whole world. Well, to the whole internet anyway. And it's a very, very hard, because of the economic imperatives we talked about earlier, it's very hard to really to know how to fix that. A lot of people are talking about government legislation and the complexity there. I suspect ultimately this might actually be what causes the change, but the complexity there is I'm talking to you from New Zealand and you're in Malaysia and you're broadcasting in Malaysia, but you have people probably streaming this and listening to it, not just in Malaysia, but in, I don't know, Singapore and Indonesia and maybe other countries in the immediate vicinity. And that's all really good and cool, but the issue is that the technology that allows that to happen allows random cyber criminals anywhere in the world, whether you're in New Zealand or Malaysia or Indonesia or Singapore or wherever, it allows random cyber criminals from anywhere else to access your stuff if the security design of your stuff is not good enough. And coming back to hammer a point from earlier, that basically is where we're at with the Internet of Things security for a lot, not all, but for a lot of things devices. So say the Malaysian government put some stringent security requirements on any kind of device that connects to the internet, that's going to be used in Malaysia to connect to the internet. So it might be that you could, that all of a sudden, all of these web cameras that were used in the Mirai botnet would presumably become illegal to sell in Malaysia. Well, that's fine, but you might be able to buy it from your favorite Chinese web store or your favorite American web store or your favorite Singaporean web store and have it shipped to you. Now, how much time and effort is the Malaysian government prepared to spend to check that that device, and they don't even know what's in the box, so they have to open, are they going to open all the boxes? How are they going to know? How much time and effort are they going to spend to check that those devices that you're importing from some other marketplace that maybe doesn't have as stringent regulation are actually up to the Malaysian regulations? So unless a large number of large governments that represent a significant chunk of the market for devices of, say, web security cameras, unless a number of countries that represent a very large proportion of all web-connected security cameras implement similar kinds of regulations, the manufacturers are probably not going to be motivated to change what they do. Some manufacturer might shrug his shoulders and say, okay, well, we won't ship 10,000 units in Malaysia this year, but we ship 120,000 units in China and 80,000 units in the US, 230,000 units in the rest of the world, so we just won't ship them to Malaysia. That helps the people in Malaysia with their privacy in the sense that they can't just go and buy those poorly designed devices, but it doesn't actually help the internet as a whole because that million other devices still got sold and are still vulnerable and can be used to attack people in Malaysia, even though the devices are not in Malaysia, were never sold in Malaysia, aren't operated by people in Malaysia, and the botnets doing the attacking, behind the botnets that are doing the attacking are not in Malaysia either. Or, I mean, they may be, but they don't have to be. And so everything else still means that the people in Malaysia are no better off. And that applies equally, really, to any other country on the planet. And so, regulations might help in the long run. As I said, it might be what gets things changed, but there's certainly very, very little economic imperative on any individual device manufacturer to do things inherently much better, because their concern is that if they're not price competitive, they won't sell enough devices to make it worth making the devices. Mm. And therefore, all those things that tend to drive the cost down that we talked about earlier, where security tends to be at the bottom of the list, are going to come into play. And it's just this nasty, vicious circle.
Nick, I know at the start of the interview you talked about, what we learned about 2016 is, number one, don't trust cybersecurity experts. But I have to ask you.
I said don't trust cybersecurity experts' predictions of what will happen in the future.
Which leads to my next question is what's your prediction for 2017 then?
Well, that's actually very, very easy, because since 2000, I've always said that whatever the next year is, so in this case 2017 will be the year of mobile malware. And it's actually a joke at the expense of a very high-ranking person in a competitor company of ours, who I won't name in the interview, because back in 1999, I think, was the first year that he predicted this, and then he continued for several years to predict this. We're still waiting. So that's my almost guaranteed to be wrong prediction. My prediction is that the bad guys will keep making money. Mm. And I think that's a very safe prediction.
It's the reality at the end of the day.
I think they will keep making a lot of money. They might very well even keep making more money than they've been making until now. Mm. And because they are now so well funded, because of the amount of money that they can make doing this stuff, they will either find some really clever, completely new way of stealing our money or stealing whatever it is that they want to steal from whoever you happen to be. Or they'll find a better way to do what they're doing already. They'll find some tweak. They'll massage the techniques that they're using. And for example, ransomware was very successful in 2015 and 2014, and everyone was predicting that it would continue to be. And it has. Don't get me wrong. It has been. But some of the ransomware people started playing with the formula a bit. And the assumption that we have to make is that they were doing it because they wanted to increase the proportion of victims who pay, because certainly not all victims pay up, and they wanted to speed up the process so victims would pay sooner. They would pay, and more of them would pay, and they would pay more quickly. And one example of that was a ransomware that started. Typically what they do is they encrypt all your files, and they've finished encrypting the files. They put up some screen on your device and say, your files are all encrypted. You can't decrypt them unless you pay us the money. You've got 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, and after that time, we're just going to throw away the key so that you'll never be able to decrypt them, or we're going to put up the price, or whatever. And there are many, many stories of people bartering the price down and dragging on the process for many, many days. And the feeling was that in doing that, that they were successful in lowering the ransom that they eventually had to pay. But one of the ransomwares in 2016 decided to take a new approach, and instead of just encrypting the files and making these terrible threats, they actually started deleting files that they'd encrypted off your hard drive, with the intention, we assume, being that that would increase the apparent threat to the victim, and the victim would be more likely to pay up, and more likely to pay up as quickly as possible, so that the files that were being randomly deleted from their hard drive every hour stopped. It would appear that that didn't actually work very well as a strategy, actually, but that was the bad guys messing with the formula, trying to work out what might work better.
Nick, it's been a pleasure talking to you, but very scared indeed as well.
No, don't be scared. Just be wary, but don't be scared.
And I've been speaking to Nick Fitzgerald, the Senior Research Fellow at ESET, talking about the increasing threat of connected devices and how to stay safe. This has been Tech Talk on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.